Welcome to Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from August 28th, 2001.
From the high desert in the great American Southwest. I bid you all good evening, good morning, good afternoon. It is only going to run this week. That's it. This week. It will begin, has begun, and will end this week. As you know, I have written a number of books. I'm not big on autographs. I'll tell you something about autographs. This is kind of interesting, and it's a trend that I've noticed in the last, couple of years. You can't imagine how many professional autograph seekers are out there. Now, these are people who really don't listen to your program at all, or don't really know you at all. Their entire life is seeking autographs from celebrities. And I presume they collect them in hopes that when you kick the bucket, you know, your autograph becomes worth money. That's all I can presume. You get these it's like getting a letter back from the president. You know, the president is very concerned with regard to the information in your letter, and the president will contact the appropriate authorities and follow up on it. You know, you get a sort of a rubber stamp letter. Hi, I've really always enjoyed your work, and I think you're fabulous. And would you please send me a signed picture, whatever? And I'm getting zillions of these, and I roundly ignore them. I totally ignore them. I never do them. There's something to me kind of macabre about that. People who would simply go to everybody who's in the public spotlight one way or the other, probably good, bad, or indifferent. You know, you could be a mass murderer. Hey, can I get your autograph? And it's just, you know, it's just for the value of the signature after you're gone. Blah, kind of strange. Huh? Anyway, as you know, I've written a number of books that really, really reflect what I think in more ways than one. The Art of Talk is my baby. The Art of Talk is an autobiography. It's all about my life. And in it, I told a whole bunch of stuff that I shouldn't have told. And to this day, get grief for. You know, I just opened up and told it the way it is. So, The Art of Talk, I think you'll like that one. The Quickening, which is every bit, you know, after I am gone and the autograph people go to collect my money or their money, if there is any to be made, $9.95, whatever, this book will still be operative because The Quickening will still be going on. Maybe. Obviously, events are racing toward some sort of culmination. The Quickening was a definitive work on that, I think. At least mine, that's for sure. And The Source, which I co-authored with Brad Steiger, about all things paranormal, having one source. Again, every bit as good today as it was the day it was written. All three of these books, autographed, personally autographed by me, are available till the end of the week, and that's it. This is like a one-time year-and-a-half special. I don't think we've done this in a year-and-a-half. So all three books autographed for $59.95 plus $7.95 shipping and handling. Or, by the way, you can get any one of the single books if you wish, but this is a pretty good bargain. $59.95, all three autographed plus $7.95 shipping and handling. You can call right now, tonight, this minute, or during the day. If you're unable to get through tonight, you can call during the day. But you ought to give it a try right now. End of the week is the end of the offer. Stay right where you are. There's so much that I should be covering that I've been saving while all of this controversy has been going on. I mean, there really is a lot going on there. And I think this could probably be classified as part of the quickening, in my opinion, and then we'll open the lines here. Let me read you about three separate emails that I've received that I think are relevant. Hey, Art, have you noticed the stories about confused animals? Fox ran a piece on a moose in a pool and also about a cub bear in a kiddie pool. One could not miss the strange behavior of the sharks off Florida. Makes you wonder something big might be brewing. Makes me glad I live in Michigan and not California, if you get my drift. You should call your guest who predicts earthquakes, see what he thinks. Or this. Hey, Art, sharks are nibbling on swimmers in the Atlantic waters. During a recent trip to Sweden, I learned that the scourges of my ancestors have returned to plague rule Swedes, the bear, the cougar, the moose, the wolf. And here in Texas, home of gigantic cockroaches referred to euphemistically as water bugs, the bugs are disappearing. The habitat of lizards has spread north. We now have a plague of these little guys. The newts, no bigger than an inch and a half, are eating cockroaches larger than they are. The lizards are like chameleons. They take on the coloration of whatever they're crawling on. My local ones don't seem to be able to match my yellow porch very well, but do a masterly job of imitating brickwork. In Florida, from the Orlando Sentinel, the headline is, Dying Birds Rain on Eola. Birds fell dead from the trees and sky around downtown Orlando's Lake Eola Park on Friday, stunning residents out for an evening stroll and leaving officials struggling to find an explanation. Nearly 100 birds began simply dropping from trees or even falling in mid-flight about 6 p.m. in the popular park on the east side of downtown. Most were grackles and pigeons, but at least one duck was found dead. Egrets and Lake Enola's famous black swans did not appear to be affected, but folks, birds just flat fell out of the sky, fell out of their perches on trees, like that. Now, what do you suppose all of this means? There can be no question. The number of shark attacks that have been going on, legs lost, bites, and all the rest of it, reported nearly on a daily basis now. Well, I'll tell you, it is part of the quickening. Be sure of it. Do the crop circles fit into all of this? Probably. Does it all mean something, and mean something is coming pretty soon now? Probably. That'd be my take anyway. I wonder what yours is. And so that's what, as I said, we're going to open lines and just see what's on your mind out there. Should we do that? First time caller line, you are on the air. Good morning.
Morning.
Hi there. Turn your radio off, please.
Okay.
Thank you. Oh, off there. There, down, all the way. Yes, good. No, turn it off.
Okay.
That's good. All right. Now, you're on the air. What is your name?
My name is Billy.
Billy. And where are you, Billy?
I am in Ashland, Kentucky.
Ashland. All right. Welcome.
I got a question, Art. I was on the website today at work, and I was looking at crop circles.
Yes.
And I noticed at the bottom of the crop circle, there is a, appears to be a humanoid shape at the bottom of it.
Are you referring now to the Chilbolton crop circle that appear that is said to be a, perhaps an answer to the Arecibo signal?
Yeah, I was looking.
Yeah,
at
that's it. Right. A fat-headed being at the bottom, right?
Right.
Okay. Yes.
And I was wondering, have they perhaps came close to maybe interpreting what any of those symbols are in the inside the fat head?
Oh, inside the head.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there's some symbols or something, you know, inside the head.
You may be looking at it too hard. All I see is a head, you know, a big head, albeit, but a head.
Okay, and, you know, me and my wife...
Either that or clean your computer screen.
That could be a good possibility there. And how far were the face? Was the face from that crop circle itself?
Okay, a way for you to gauge that yourself is to go to the photograph on my website of the two glyphs, the face and the answer, and look at them in relationship to the great big satellite dish there.
Okay.
Do you see the satellite dish?
Yes.
Okay, that satellite dish is 80 feet in diameter.
Wow.
So if you just sort of, you know, use a little anything and measure the 80 feet and go on out, it'll help you.
Okay, I appreciate it. Me and my wife, we just really feel that this is going to be the beginning of something tremendous. And a lot of people here in the area feel that way, too.
Then you and your wife and myself are in total agreement. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
Take care. Wildcard Line, you are on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. This is Raymond. I'm calling from Michigan.
Yes, sir.
My niece and nephew, they're 5 years old. They're twins. And they're in preschool. And they came home and told their mom, my sister, their mom one day, something that I thought was pretty cool that I didn't know they were doing. They're teaching them in preschool about Bigfoot.
What?
Yeah, how about that?
No.
I don't think they're teaching high schoolers that.
No. No.
Yeah, little boy came home.
Sure? Are you sure?
Yeah, he said they're learning about Bigfoot, and he explained to my sister exactly what it was, and he said he loved it. And
What is the school teaching about Bigfoot? I mean, what are they saying? Do you know?
Well, I don't know. No, I don't live that near them, so I talk to him on the phone every once in a while. But he just said he came home, they were teaching them in school. They told them about Bigfoot.
Bigfoot is your friend.
Well, he said that what he got out of it was, you know, he ended up saying to my sister that, you know, he really thought Bigfoot was neat and everything. And
really neat, huh?
And I went and rented them the movie Harry and the Hendersons, thinking it would...
Oh, now, Harry and the Hendersons, now, I'm not sure that represents Bigfoot as we understand Bigfoot.
No, it doesn't, but I didn't want him to be afraid of it.
And how old are these two?
5 years old.
5 years old.
The girl
and what are what are their names?
Jake and Katie.
Jake and Katie. So, little Jake and Katie, in case you should be awake at this hour, here's my version of Bigfoot. Now, if they were to include that reputed to be real Bigfoot sound in the curriculum, how do you think Jake and Katie would handle it?
I think the bad dreams would begin immediately.
Thank you very much. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Good morning, evening, whatever.
Art.
Yes.
Yeah, I can't believe I got through. This is Kurt. I'm calling from Youngstown.
Yes, Kurt.
I'm a time zone traveler from Phoenix, though.
You're a time zone traveler from Phoenix.
Right. You know what that is?
Yeah, that's when you go from one time zone to another.
Right. Truck driver.
Okay. Oh, is that what that means? All right.
Yeah. I just thought of that one night. I have a lot of time to think when I'm driving and listening to you. But anyways, I've always wanted to give you a theory of UFOs.
Okay.
As far as like...
You mean a theory, like, a theory of what they are, you mean?
Yeah, of what's going on.
Okay.
As far as like, you know, how we think that we come from Mars. There's evidence of being coming from Mars. And I think possibly it's UFOs are actually repopulating the next Earth. Possibly, you never know.
What do you mean the next Earth?
Yeah, if it's destroyed before, Mars was destroyed before, we have this series that it's going to happen again. So they're repopulating the Earth, the next Earth.
Now think about this. Maybe the cycle of destruction... visits itself on Earth and Mars every now and then, every a few million years or something like that. So maybe the truth is every few million years, the population has got to move back and forth, Earth to Mars, Mars to Earth, Earth to Mars.
Right. Well, it has to go to a new one, but you never know. It could be Venus, the next one. You know,
Venus is not so friendly for human beings.
Well, according to the reversals, speech reversals, the guys from NASA were coming up with Americans and Venus on Mars, Americans and buildings on Venus or whatever.
Well, maybe, but would you get on a rocket bound for Venus as your new home because you've got a one-way ticket, right? Based on speech reversals? If the guy from NASA said, listen, Earth is... you know, in its last minutes here, and you're going to get to be one of the ones to make it to the new home, Venus. And we've got these speech reversals that seem to justify our sending you there. Hop on board. I don't think so. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Good morning. Going once, going twice. Gone. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. This is the Art Bell program, Coast to Coast AM.
It would appear so.
I would hope so. Yeah, I was going to just call and respond to an issue about the sharks.
Ah, yes, the sharks. And for that matter, a lot of the other animals behaving all of a sudden.
Absolutely.
In kind of a strange way, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely.
Have you ever seen this many shark stories, ever?
No, I have not.
Right.
One of the strange thing what I was calling to talk about is that this is not the first time in history that this has happened. This has happened in several documented cases.
Probably happened before the big meteor hit the Yucatan, for example, but,
yeah.
You know, we don't remember.
But, you know, one of the instances, I mean, you know, there was a film a few years ago called The Ghost in the Darkness that came out, which was just a film, of course, but based on the true incident of these lions in a place called Tsavo in Africa that basically just started randomly killing 100 people, two of them, for no particular reason at all. And the fact of the matter is lions don't normally do such a thing, and they, I believe, by the end of it, killed about 100 people.
The lions killed. You know what? I think I remember that story, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do recall that story. In fact, they went on a real human eaten rampage. Mm-hmm. Listen, can you hold on?
Absolutely.
Stay right there. We'll be right back from the high desert. This is Coast to Coast AM in open lines. I'm Art Bell.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from August 28, 2001. Play of Coast to Coast AM from August 28, 2001.
This song absolutely haunts me, and I don't know why, but it haunts me in a very pleasant kind of way. So different than anything else he did. Good morning, everybody. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Hello, everybody. From the desert of the sea, this is Maggie. Do you want to take a ride?
You got to admit, that's pretty cute. At the top of the hour, we're going to be talking with an FBI agent, a woman. I call her Clarice. She's actually Candace DeLong, but, you know, when you think of a woman FBI agent, you know, that's really stereotyping, too. I mean, you have to think of Clarice, right, and Hannibal. You just have to. So we'll ask her about that. She worked on cases like that, too. So it's going to be kind of interesting. Have you ever seen a time like this when things are so strange? They just seem to get stranger and faster and stranger and faster. And West Nile virus now is spreading as well. We're talking about the animals, but West Nile virus is headed my way. It moves south, and it's moving west, and I would presume that before too long, despite the authorities' best efforts to eradicate the mosquito, something I don't think they're going to do, it's moving, and it's moving toward me and us in general. And you're back on the air again, sir.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. First off, I just wanted to say quickly that in these times where we have practically no coverage of the paranormal at all anywhere, and specifically about the subjects that have been happening over the past week, which I won't get into, which everyone knows. I appreciate your show.
I thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be able to cover stuff that are, you know, I haven't mentioned the whole Condit thing, and I'm not really going to, although I've asked tonight's guest about it, but I have had it. I mean, I just, you know, anytime you turn on the news now, that's all you can get, and I guess I wonder why.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the bigger scheme of things, it seems so, so insignificant.
Yeah, absolutely. In comparison with the face in a field in England, I really don't care about Condit, you know, sorry.
Yeah, maybe we're not plugged in the right way or something, sir, but I absolutely agree with you.
Yeah. I guess mainly what I was going to call about tonight is you were talking about the recent rash of shark attacks.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. And basically I was just going to bring up the idea that this is not may not be new news to anyone, but this is strange. This has happened several times in history. Never has there been more sharks, of course, but yes, there's also been other attacks recently. There was a bear in Florida.
That's right.
I believe came into a suburb and attacked a woman.
Correctamundo.
There was I believe I even heard of an otter, like several otters killing someone.
Yep.
About several weeks ago, and I thought that was absurd. When it gets to the point where otters are killing people.
Yep. Lots of bear coming down, jumping
yeah.
in pools, swimming. I mean, there's all kinds of strange animal behavior going on right now, and it probably means something if we were smart enough to listen.
And, I mean, you know, a few years ago there was a film release called The Ghost in the Darkness, which many people may remember. That was a true story, which is basically about two lions in an area of Africa called Tsavo about 100 years or so ago. And the British were trying to build a bridge, basically, across this area of land.
I saw the movie.
Yeah. You know, just in case anyone hasn't, you know.
And these things just decided to turn on humans, and they picked them off one by one by one by one. It was horrible.
It was about it. Death count was just tremendous.
I saw the movie, sir, and I appreciate the call. You're absolutely right. For anybody out there willing to listen, the behavior of animals is odd right now. Can you deny that? I don't think so. Speaking of animals, I have got a really, 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 really cute picture on my webcam right now that I got tonight. First time ever, I got both of my pinky cats, meaning I've got a picture of myself holding Comet. He's the one on the left with his ears back, and Yeti, our darling new one, on the right, and they're together. And taking a picture like that with those two is a flesh-threatening experience. But I did get them to calm down and pay attention. And now, Comet, you know, if you get a camera, any kind of thing that looks like a camera, within 20 feet of Comet, he'll be gone like, you know, the speeding bullet after Superman. I mean, he's just gone. He knows a camera. But he doesn't know my webcams because they're always there, and he hasn't figured out their cameras yet. So it's the only way I've ever, in recent years, been able to get a picture of Comet. He's the one on the left, totally feral. The one on the right is our new little monster named Yeti. He's something else. But I got them both in one photograph. It's on my webcam right now. If you go to my website at artbell.com, click on program. What does it say? It says there? Program, and then Art Bell Studio Cam. You'll see the picture I took at 9:49 Pacific time, just a few minutes ago, actually. On the international line, you are on the air. Where are you, pray tell?
Australia.
Australia, welcome to the program.
How you going? Good. What I wanted to talk to you about was clairvoyance, psychics. How much faith do you put in them?
Well, let me put it to you this way. It's my view, after years of interviewing some of the best of them, that some of them absolutely are real and have a talent that, whether you like it or not, is real, and they can really do what they say they do, and then there are some charlatans. So on the one hand, I absolutely believe the phenomena is a real phenomenon, no question about it. On the other hand, I know there are charlatans out there, too.
Well, how does one then decide who's a charlatan and who's for real? How do you do that, do you know?
Well, you have to be intuitive. I don't know when I really don't want to say anything bad about anybody, but when I see something on TV, and it says, want to know about your boyfriend? Want to know if your girlfriend's going out on you? Call 1-900, you know, whatever. I tend to sort of blow that off in my mind, probably like a lot of people, right? But on the other hand, when I run into somebody like Danion Brinkley, who scared the you-know-what out of me several times with his ability, I know I've met the real McCoy. So,
this fellow, we've got him on TV down here now, John Edwards.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, of course. John started off on the Science Fiction Channel, and now he's in syndication and apparently has reached all the way to Australia. John Edwards says he talks to the other side. You know, I don't know. I think there is another side. I think I'm pretty well convinced of that. I doubt that our energy ceases, so I really tend to believe, you know, there is a place where we go, or a time, or maybe it's no time and no place, but a place where our consciousness resides after physical death. I'm more cautious about those who claim to speak to that side. But maybe. Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hello.
Yes, good evening, Art. It's John in Scottsdale.
Hi, John.
I'm sitting out in my backyard in my trampoline looking at a football moon arcing its way to the western goalpost horizon.
Oh, I bet it's a beautiful night, too. People have no idea how nice the desert is at night. Now, during the day here, it's been going about 111. I bet it's more than Phoenix.
Yeah, a bit hellish, yes.
But once the sun goes down, you have this wonderful dry air. Here, for example, at the moment, it's 88 degrees.
Correct.
And it is just beautiful out there.
Yeah, it's very nice. What I wanted to discuss with you tonight was last night's program.
Yes.
I got onto the website before the show began, and I was waiting with eagerness to hear about the some new information with the crop glyphs and all that, because my son and I have been watching it pretty closely. In fact, he was doing some diddling with the artwork and produced some interesting...
Wait a minute, I'm getting a psychic vision. There's a plane going
yes,
over your
house. Yes. Yes, strobe lights ablaze and heading towards Scottsdale Airport over here.
And it's a female pilot, about 34, not bad.
Yeah, she's good looking, I can see it.
And anyway, back to the crop circles.
Sure. We were looking at the images that were lined up for the night's program, and it looked like there was quite a bit of factual material to absorb, and we were rubbing our hands and waiting for the show to start.
Mm-hmm.
And then... And then he started getting into it with Seth, and I have to say, I don't want to complain, because this is the best damn show ever.
You can bitch all you want.
Well, I'm going to, because the man really doesn't know anything about crop circles. And I was sitting there...
To be fair, though, he doesn't pretend to.
Okay, but it just seemed like he was getting in the way of what might have been intended... as some good information, and I can
sense
Richard's
listen, not to, don't worry. Radio is a long-form thing. Now, in all likelihood, I'll have Richard on again tomorrow night. I'll tell you a little secret.
Yeah.
Richard has talked to the Chilbolton Observatory.
Oh, yeah?
And so he's going to have a bit of news for us.
Ah, good. That'll be nice.
Yes. We're sort of letting this story continue to develop and... we'll go over all of that stuff. Don't worry.
All right, my friend, your steak awaits you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. East of the Rockies, you're on the air, top of the morning. Hello.
Good evening, Art.
Good evening, sir. Where are you?
I am in Mansfield, Ohio. This is Doug.
Okay, Doug.
Yes, I am so glad I got through, and I think you will be, too. Last December 20th.
By the blue tile walls, there's a market stall. There's a hidden door she leads you to. These days, she says, I feel my life just like a river running through the air of the cat. Yeah.
Radio Networks presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired August 28, 2001.
In a few moments, we're going to enter the world of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. We've got a gal who was there for a whole career, Candace DeLong. Of course, you're going to think, as I have, of Clarice Starling. How can you not? There aren't that many women. Well, I guess there are a lot of women down there. I will ask. I don't know how many women are in the FBI, but she was, and she's got a lot of good stories to tell tonight. I'm very respectful of the saxophone. For me, it's like a cat purring, you know, it calms me down. Anyway, good morning, everybody. I'm Art Bell, and if you'll stay right where you are, we're going going into a whole different world in just a moment. The book is Special Agent. My Life on the Front Lines as a Woman in the FBI. For 20 years, Candace DeLong was on the front lines of some of the FBI's most memorable and gripping cases. Some have called her a real-life Clarice Starling and a female Donnie Brasco. She's tailed terrorists, gone undercover as a gangster's moll, was one of the agents chosen to carry out the manhunt for the Unabomber in Montana. That must have been really frightening. For the first time, she reveals the dangers and rewards of her career as a field profiler in the FBI. A field profiler. I guess we're going to find out in a moment what that is. Here is Candace DeLong. Candace, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Hi. It's great to have you. I understand you just got off an airplane, huh?
Yeah, just a few minutes ago.
Where were you coming from?
I was flying from Northern California to Southern.
And you're in Southern California now?
Yes.
Okay. Let's see, 20 years. You would have been then one of the first women FBI agents, period, wouldn't you?
Well, the first women came in 1972. They admitted just one, and she was admitted a few hours after Hoover's soul ascended into heaven, assuming that's where it went. And then they just, it was just a trickle of women, one, and then two, and then three. And when I came in 1980, there was only about 4% of the workforce was female, and that's where I was.
Do you think J. Edgar Hoover went to heaven?
I have no evidence that he didn't.
Why did you even want to go into the FBI?
Well, Art, I had been a psychiatric nurse for almost a decade, and I had spent most of my nursing career in maximum security, and I had eventually become head nurse of a major metropolitan psychiatric hospital at one. And, you know, the psych nursing's pretty draining, very stressful job. And in 1978, I met an FBI agent, and we became friends. And he introduced me to his partner one day, and his partner was a little teeny gal, about 5 feet tall, 100 pounds, hair down to her waist, really cool suede boots.
And were you jealous?
Oh, damn, yeah. Oh, yeah, sorry.
No, that's all right. You can say which one. If you say anything too awful, I'll bleep it out. No problem.
And I thought, what the heck? I didn't know women could. I didn't know the FBI. You know, I knew about federal agents. Elliot Ness was kind of a mythical figure in my family. My dad was an informant for him during the Great Depression.
Ooh.
Yeah. So I kind of grew up he saw her all about his symptoms so that when he saw her on such and such a date, she would be ready to order all the tests that he would need, and she would be able to do everything in one day, and he would not have to stay overnight. Mm. And, of course, he was always counting his pennies. And, I mean, literally, this man lived on about $300 a year.
Yeah, I saw his cabin, if you can call it that.
Yeah. And so, in this letter, he said, he wrote the letter in 1992, and he said, I've been under stress for about 14 years. Well, if you subtract 14 years from 1992, that's 1978 when he placed the first bomb in Chicago.
Right.
And he said in that letter, I've been under extreme stress since I've been under extreme stress the last 5 years. 5 years prior to 1992 was when he was seen placing a bomb down behind a computer store in Utah. and was seen by someone, and the composite sketch of the Unabomber became famous to America.
Did you read his manifesto?
Yeah, when I needed to get to sleep, yeah. I couldn't get through it. I read it. To me, it was interesting, parts of it, but it read like a doctoral dissertation.
Yes.
Was not I just decided to wait till the movie came out.
Really? Portions of it, I thought, actually were brilliant. He was actually a brilliant man.
Oh, yes.
In a lot of ways, wasn't
no
he?
No doubt about it. Misguided for sure, though.
Misguided for sure. But then finally, the judge signs, and you and I suppose a whole bunch of others sort of assault that little cabin, right?
Not exactly. What I left out here was after 3 weeks of my partners and I running around much, and I would use the word guarded, stiff, much like Congressman Condit was last Thursday night with Connie Chung. Gee, how'd I get that work in? And
I don't know. It's the first time anybody's mentioned it on my show.
You know, yeah, I mean, you certainly knew you were sitting across the table from a smart person, but oh, how I wanted to reach over and go, not feeling so smart now, are you?
You didn't do that, huh?
No. Despite what Hollywood would have you think about cops and agents slapping people around and using...
Wait a minute, you don't slap people around?
Not in my professional life, no.
You're just in your private life a little bit, huh?
Well, yeah.
That's surprising. One of my favorite shows on TV is Law & Order. I think it's a wonderful program.
Yes.
They occasionally slap people around.
There are no federal agents on that show.
Well, that's true. So federal agents don't do that.
He was an FBI agent for 20 years. I worked with DEA agents. I worked with periodically ATF agents. And no, you know what? We don't. That's Hollywood nonsense.
Is it?
I never saw anyone do anything. Well, first of all,
so
you realize
in New York City homicide, you don't think a suspect could get slapped around?
Oh no, I think they could. Yeah. And I think they. You know, I work with Chicago homicide cops too, and yeah, I think that probably does happen. I never witnessed it because you do know that the FBI has jurisdiction for investigating police brutality. It's a federal violation, a civil rights violation.
Oh, yeah.
So most cops would be rather, well, not too very smart to slap a suspect around in front of an FBI agent.
Oh, absolutely. In front of an FBI agent. Sure.
Right.
When you and your partner, whether it was not the Kaczynski case, but in a case where you would be interrogating someone, have you played good cop, bad cop? Is that a really common thing to do?
If I'm having a moody day, I can play both roles by myself. That PMS thing can really work in your favor if you're a female agent.
I wouldn't have said it.
I'll say it. I'm proud of it.
Just really nice one moment and ripping into them the next moment.
That's right.
That actually does work, doesn't it? In other words, whether it's you at any single moment or you and your partner, the good cop, bad cop thing really works.
It can, with an inexperienced or what we call criminally unsophisticated suspect. Yeah, it can.
The FBI, though, more times than not, is dealing with more sophisticated folks, aren't they?
Oftentimes. Of course, we also deal with what I call raggedy-ass bank robbers all the way up to extremely brilliant terrorists.
Just before the break here, I have one quick question for you. What year would you expect, Candace, that we would see the first female FBI director?
I think probably within a decade.
Within a decade?
Mm-hmm.
So by say, 2012?
Yes.
If we're all still here.
I don't know that she'll come up through the ranks as Louis Freeh did. But, yeah, I can imagine within a decade we'll have a female director.
Things really have changed. Hold it right there. We'll be right back. Top of the hour, I'm Art Bell.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from August 28, 2001.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
There's a smile for his nostalgic tale. Never come
Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from August 28, 2001.
Candace DeLong, 20 years in the FBI as a special agent, is my guest tonight. And I just went searching on Amazon.com and found her book, looking for a photograph of her. And they've got the book there for a special agent, My Life on the Front Lines as a Woman in the FBI. And they slashed the price. That's what Amazon.com does. I don't know how they can do that, but they do. It's a really good book. And I went searching for her picture. It's not on the front of the book, but guess what? It's on the back. It certainly is. I just had my wife get the book, and it's on the back. And I'll tell you all about it in a moment. Years in the FBI. Well, there's no picture of Candace on the front of the book, you know, but on the back of the book, there's a great big full back cover picture of Candace DeLong, and boy, those are big guns. I mean, it's a big gun. You're really cute. You're really cute, Candace.
Oh, cute.
What kind of gun is that? My God.
That's a Glock.
It's a Glock. Yeah, I thought it might be a Glock. That's my...
However, that's what we call it. My son calls the DDS, the DeLong Death Stare. When he was young,
right.
I could control him in a restaurant just glaring at him like that. It comes in very happy in my personal life, too.
It does look like a death stare. You're right. And I'm sure they took this picture. That wasn't a standard FBI picture, of course. That was done for the book, right?
Yeah. I was already retired.
I see. Boy, they picked a big Glock, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, I'm a little gal.
How tall are you?
5'5".
5'5". All right. Such a good-looking woman. 20 years.
Thank you.
You know, they must have... Did they ever use you as bait?
I use myself as bait. There's a couple stories in the book. One of my favorite stories is in a chapter called Girl Talk.
Oh.
Where from start to finish, started at noon, was over at 8 p.m., and I convinced this suspect that I was after that I was the head of a call girl operation called the Candy Store, no less. And it's one of my favorite stories. It's great fun. And
well, tell me about it.
Well, I friend it. Well, someone...
Trust me, they'll still buy your book. Don't worry.
I was driving in my bureau car one day, and over the bureau radio, not the good time radio, which is AM/FM, but the bureau radio, someone was talking very, very dirty. And
over the bureau radio?
Over the bureau radio. And believe me, you can't even swear over the bureau radio, let alone talk very, very dirty.
Gotcha.
And I thought, oh, my God, so, you know, somebody's gotten hold of one of our radios, is either in a bureau car or stole a handy talkie,
right,
which is the same frequency.
Right.
And as it turns out, when I got back to the office, that's what I found out, that somebody had broken in to a car, and of course our cars are unmarked. They apparently didn't. No one was responding to them. None of the agents were saying any. Nobody indicated that, you know, to the offender, we'll call him, that he actually was talking dirty over the FCC airways on an FBI radio.
Oh,
and so I thought, well, gee, you know, we've got to get our radio back. And also, he had stolen $3,000 of camera equipment from the same trunk of the car that he stole this from. And so I went to the bosses and I said, look, all he's asking for is sex. Let's give it to him. You know, and they looked at me like I was crazy. And I said, look, I think we're dealing with a kid here, you know, meaning a teenager. All he wants is sex. He wants this. He wants that. Let me go on the air and convince him that I'm a madam and that I communicate with my girls through handy talkies and I send them to their assignments.
On the FBI frequency.
Well, on the same frequency he was using, of course.
Was he aware that he was on an FBI
frequency? Absolutely not.
I see.
Which also told me that we were dealing with someone pretty young and unsophisticated.
Right.
Most retired agents and cops. I mean, you put people in jail over the years, you know, sometimes they hold a grudge.
Sure.
I'm not aware of any FBI agent that's ever been injured or killed by someone they put in jail many years later. Certainly FBI agents and family members have been threatened and have had to be relocated. But it's pretty hard to find me. I'm very cautious. You know, it just would be difficult. And you know, I just use a lot of common sense. I'm really irritable. So.
Really irritable. Did you ever run into a bad FBI agent? And when I say bad, I mean bad cop.
I was going to say someone I didn't like. Let's see. No.
Uh-huh.
In terms of like Robert Hansen.
Yeah.
No. I'm happy to say they are few and far between.
Who investigates the FBI, Candace?
Department of Justice.
How frequently does that occur?
Pretty often.
Does it really?
Yeah. You know, I mean, being in the FBI, you know, I call it it's a Catholic school again. There's a lot of rules and regulations. I even have a chapter in my book where I ran afoul of bureau regulations. You're not allowed to have a second job, and when I needed money, I periodically would moonlight as a nurse. I'm a registered nurse.
Don't they pay FBI agents enough?
Well, they didn't. You know, I was a single parent, and, you know, living in a major city was pretty tough making ends meet, and I would periodically work as a nurse,
mm-hmm.
and that's a no-no. It's not against the law. It's against bureau rules. And so anytime an agent breaks a rule, whether it's minor or major, and not to mention breaking the law, then they are investigated. Now, we used to investigate ourselves, but now we're investigated by the Department of Justice.
You think that's a good idea?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of our rules and regulations are a little ridiculous, and I talk about that in my book, not just because I got caught moonlighting as a nurse. Hey, I broke the rules, and I paid the price for it. But there are agents in the Bureau who are not making cases and not whipping off enough adrenaline for themselves, and so they sit around and they file ridiculous complaints on other agents, and they all have to be investigated. And this costs taxpayers time and money. And so some of them I think are ridiculous, and probably 60%, I'm told, are bogus.
One of my closest friends in life has been a man named John Pyre, mm-hmm. Candace. He spent 20-plus in the FBI and retired.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we had a lot of conversations. John and I talked a lot, and he complained endlessly about the politics in the FBI.
Yes.
True?
Yes. Yes. You know, like any other organization and the bureaucracy. You know, people interview me. I've probably had 200-plus interviews since April 19th, when the book first came out in Great Britain, and then here in America, May 1st.
Aren't you tired of it all?
Well, no. But one of the most frequently asked questions is, Candace, you had such a great career. There's a lot of good stories in this book. You could have gone 7 more years. Why did you leave? Don't you miss it? Well,
that's right.
You just asked me a question. There's my answer. The politics and the bureaucracy.
Yeah.
What a great career. Hey, love to stay. Gotta go.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel free now?
Oh, free at last.
Yeah.
Free at last.
Does the politics get so bad that it prevents at times competent law enforcement?
Well, it can. I think it's not so much the politics. Most FBI agents would say this to you. Maybe not while they're on board, but give them a light beer and they will. And it is this. It's not so much the politics. Yes, the politics exists. The biggest problem with the FBI is FBI management. Competent agents learn how to navigate the management waves so that you can work through them. You know, I talk about in my book, you know, sometimes the best way to get something done is to go ahead and do it, and better to ask forgiveness than permission.
Yeah, when you wrote the book, I know when I sat down to write my autobiography, I had, before I even, you know, wrote the first word, I spent a lot of time thinking about, well, what am I going to write? Am I going to write really nice stuff about myself, or really awful stuff, or am I just going to write it all? And I finally decided, the hell with it. Who cares if everybody gets mad at me? I'm just going to write the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what I did, and I'm still in trouble for it with a lot of people. I wonder if you went through that same process.
Well,
you must have.
Yes, I did. I went through that process. I didn't want my book to be what I would call a bitch and moan fest.
Mm-hmm.
And I pretty much, it's like going through labor and having a baby.
Hmm.
I left out the bad and put in the good. Although, I've noticed I've got about 28 reader reviews on Amazon.com now.
Yes, I just checked them out. By the way, you did actually very well. It looks to me like, where are the stars? One, two, three, four and a half stars.
Yes, I'm very happy.
Based on 29 reviews up there, that's really good.
29? Well, there's one I don't know about. What I'm really happy about is that men as well as women seem to like the book. Law enforcement as well as civilian. I'm really happy with what people think about the book. But as I was saying, what I did was, you know, and what I'm happy about, a lot of these reader reviews, people are saying, gee, I really gave them an inside look at the FBI, including some of the bad stuff. People have no idea what I didn't put in that book. Trust me, I'm saving that for the TV series.
What kind of stuff, without being specific, what kind of stuff did you not put in the book?
Oh, treachery, betrayal, backstabbing among agents.
Oh, you mean normal FBI life?
Yeah, pretty much, you know. And that's before you even, you know, get to 10 a.m. You know, incompetence, jealousy, you know, women sleeping with the boss to get what they want. I mean, any female professional sleeping with the boss, in my opinion, is the anti-feminist. And you know, and when you're in law enforcement and you're in a predominantly male-dominated profession, to be sleeping with the boss is just the worst.
Well, you know, I once interviewed a very brilliant female lawyer,
mm-hmm.
and she advocated, and not only advocated, but in fact slept her way to the top. And she said, it's the only way to go.
Well, I never took that route, and
I would
vehemently disagree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway,
well, she
I left a lot of that stuff out, and but it'll make for a good TV series, I can tell you that.
All right, do you want to have a TV series?
There's a lot of interest in Hollywood for that. I'm not at liberty to give more details, but it could go that direction.
Really? Mm-hmm. You realize that if you were to have a TV series,
or mutilate them after death.
Mm-hmm.
Torture is what the word we use for something done to a victim before they're dead. Mutilate is something a word we use for after they're dead. Very different types of people commit those different acts, and we know this through tremendous amount of research that's been done especially by the early profilers. Research has been done interviewing these guys in prison, learning how they operate, the experience of the investigators, and statistics play a role in profiling. Let me give you one that I talk about in my book. Highly significant, and I've quoted a different statistic for the last 5 weeks since I've been a media consultant on the Chandra Levy case. But before we get on to that, this is a statistic I use in my book, and this gives you an example of how important statistics can be, although they're not probable cause for an arrest or search warrant, but just
an investigative tool.
Right. 95% of the time, approximately 95% of the time, a child under 10 years old dies of blunt force trauma to the head in their own home. The killer was an adult primary caretaker. Who are the primary caretakers of adult? Usually mom, dad, and or adult babysitter. What we know about children... Okay, first of all, what you are looking at when you have a child under 10 years old killed in their own home and they died of a skull fracture,
right.
You are looking at the results of an adult that lost their temper and hit that child too hard,
mm-hmm.
either with their own hand or with an instrument. That's what you're looking at. Now, that's generally not a premeditated murder. That would, you know, you're looking at manslaughter, still murder.
Sure it is.
You know, but generally it's not premeditated.
Huh.
What we do know because of studying so many child murders, when kids kill each other, when a seven-year-old kills a sister,
yes.
They don't kill them that way. And by the way, that almost never happens where siblings kill each other, even in anger. Sometimes it's accidental.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, you're not going to see, you rarely see a seven-year-old picking up a baseball bat and smashing the skull of a three-year-old. It happens not too often. And generally what happens is what we know when these things happen, the adult in the house picks up the phone and calls 911. Now, that's a very, very high statistic, 95%.
It sure is.
What it tells you is you have to look at every adult that was in the house at the time the child died, and they must be eliminated first before you look out. You look for other suspects. Now, let me tell you about another statistic.
Sure.
100% of the time of the cases that the FBI looked at where a child died in their own home, and it was a staged crime scene.
Right.
The killer was mom or dad or stepdad or a primary caretaker. 100% of the time. They looked at something like 200 cases.
Oh, that's incredible.
Right.
That really is incredible.
So that is, okay, another example, because I've been all over the TV. I've done about 50 TV spots since Chandra Levy disappeared.
Right.
And I do talk about this in my book because I did most of the crimes that I was involved in profiling, the victims were women or children. Women and children tend to be the victims of sex offenders.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, let's get your take on the whole Chandra Levy thing.
Okay, well,
It's absolutely done. I've never seen anything like it. I don't see people can stand it. It's dominating all the press.
Thank you, Mr. Condit, for an interesting summer.
Yeah.
All right. Here's another statistic in response to your question about let's talk about the Chandra Levy case.
Sure.
30% of the time, an adult woman is killed in America, murdered in America.
Yes.
She was murdered by a man with whom she had an intimate relationship, either a current or past husband, boyfriend, or lover.
One-third of the time.
One-third. Now, a full another 46%, bringing it up to around 76% of women, are murdered by someone that they know. That's pretty high.
So keep your eye on the ones you love, huh?
Yep. Don't turn your back. Now...
That all goes to motive. I mean, most murders are murders of passion one way or the other.
Anger, revenge,
except for the total sickos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, so somebody said to me on one of, but Ms. DeLong, that leaves a full 24% are being killed by serial killers. No.
No.
The other 24% are women who are at a convenience store at the wrong time when somebody comes in and starts shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Women that are in a bank robbery when someone starts shooting. A little girl or an 18-year-old girl walking home from high school and she's caught in the crossfire of a gang shootout.
Why do you say women? Why isn't it equally possible that a man in the wrong place at the wrong time in a convenience store likely to be shot?
Absolutely can be. I'm just talking about... The percentage of time a woman is killed, 76% of the time it's someone that she knows.
Gotcha.
And someone, I just want to point out to your listeners, the other 24% are not serial killers. In fact, the number of women killed by serial killers, I would imagine it's less than 1%.
Hmm.
It's highly rare, but they get all the publicity.
So look to the ones you love
The ones you know. I was assigned to the San Francisco Division. In 1995, I transferred there from Chicago, having spent 25 years in Chicago, 15 of which with the FBI. And in the first few months I were there, there were three major news stories of women that were killed, raped and murdered in their own homes by men who had been there before. Carpet cleaners, a delivery man, and one woman in her case, her front door was open, and some kids were walking by, and they were high on dope, and they just decided to go in and kill somebody.
You know what, Candace? These are all killings that, even horrible as they are, we understand them because there's motive.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, the American public is, and always has been, fascinated with people who kill without apparent motive. Now, obviously, there's always motive, sick personal motive, perhaps, but serial killers. For some reason, we have a special fascination for serial killers. Why?
I think, it started in the early 80s when the FBI started looking at the early pioneers of profiling, started looking at people that committed this murders repeatedly, murdered people they didn't even know, in what appeared to be a motiveless crime.
Mm-hmm.
They appear to be motiveless. In fact, they are not without motive.
There are also sexier crimes for the FBI, too, if truth be told, right?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Right.
You know, and much more difficult to solve.
Yeah, of course. Of course. So how much do you know about serial killers?
Well, probably more than the average person because I've had a tremendous amount of training. From the behavioral science unit, and I read everything I can get my hands on, and was involved in a number of cases that involve serial killers, and one particular story I have in my book called The Bad Guy. It's about a notorious serial killer in Illinois who killed women and children.
They're almost always guys, right?
99% of the time.
Yep, serial killers.
I'm only aware of one serial killer that was a woman, and she would pick up a guy in a bar, entice him. He would take her back to a hotel. She would have sex with him and kill him and steal his money.
Black Widow.
Yeah, generally when women are serial killers, it's for profit. You marry a rich guy, poison him, you know, he looks like he died of a heart attack, get his money. Marry another rich guy, you know.
Uh-huh.
Or what we see, these euthanasia serial killers, nurses that kill people.
But it can't just be for money, because they do it again and again, so there's some other element there,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, but it's not there's no sexual component to it. There's no sadistic component to their personality. It's not like the Ted Bundy type of serial killings that we see. Stalking, the luring, the...
What percentage of the time in serial killer cases is part of the crime or the gratification for the crime sexual?
Well, I would say a fairly high percentage, more than 50%, that there is a sexual component to the crime.
Hmm. What you would call the main motivation for the crime, or is it secondary to it?
Well, you know, the killers themselves, I mean, even Ted Bundy said the sex was really perfunctory to the actual taking of the life is what became so powerful to him. Knowing that you have the power to let this person live or die, and that's what he really got off on.
Should Ted Bundy have been executed?
Should he have been?
Yeah.
Well, in Bundy's particular case, there wasn't a great deal to be learned. It was only a few days before he was to be executed before he finally went, okay, you got me, I did it.
Mm-hmm.
Here, ask me anything you want. There was a book written, a very, very interesting book, very revealing book, called The Only Living Witness. It was written by two journalists, one of whom's name is Stephen Michaud, and I hope that the other one's listening, he forgives me. I don't remember his name, and Stephen Michaud, what they did was they got Bundy to talk in third person. Okay, you didn't do it, but tell us about the type of person that might have. And so they got Bundy to talk in third person, and it was pretty revealing. Pretty revealing. I have no problem with Bundy being executed. If you ask me that because you're wondering, couldn't we have learned from him? He wouldn't let us.
That is why I asked. Yes.
Yeah. You know what the absolute worst thing that whatever happened regarding, you know, after Ted Bundy was apprehended, some woman married him while he was on death row. Okay, that's not my problem. That's
Figures.
Her problem. But he was allowed to have a conjugal visit, and he procreated a child with this woman.
You're kidding.
No, you didn't know?
No, I have no idea.
Yeah.
No.
She always maintained he was innocent. And, of course, until the last few days, and he went, yep, I killed all these women. And then he told us about some people we didn't even know he'd killed. And, he actually was allowed to have that's my problem. No one convicted of murder and on death row should ever be allowed to have any happiness.
Do you have a problem executing mentally ill?
Absolutely.
You do?
I was a psychiatrist for 10 years.
How could Bundy not have been classically mentally ill?
Because, well, in his day, he would have been diagnosed a psychopath, and that is a clinical term that has now evolved to the term evolved to sociopath, and now it evolved to antisocial personality disorder. Basically, that is a clinical term for a butthead. We call character disorder. It's just a... I work with the mentally ill for 10 years. I mean, I work with people that literally heard voices in their head that told them they were evil and that they needed to eat flies because they were unworthy of food, and they were very delusional.
Psychotic, schizophrenic, yeah.
Yes, but mentally ill.
So is a... compulsion to kill. I mean, it's a mighty fine line in a lot of ways, isn't it?
Well, you know, it is, but, you know, the interesting thing is the vast majority of schizophrenics that are delusional and hear voices and think that spaceships are drying up their blood, they really commit crimes. I mean, take a look. I want your listeners to think, the next time they look at a homeless person on the street, the homeless people on the street that never look at you and ask you for money are probably schizophrenic. They're hearing voices. They're delusional. They do not like people. They do not like being around people. They can't stand to be touched. They are very unlikely to go up to you and say, do you have any spare change? The people that are holding up signs saying, you know, we'll work for money,
right?
You know, or say, hey, buddy, have you got a, you know, can you spare a dime? Can you buy me a cup of coffee? Chances are they're not mentally ill. The very seriously mentally ill are that they don't even approach you. And they rarely commit crimes, although sometimes their delusions and their psychoses, meaning out of touch with reality, does result in them committing a crime. I would like to talk about the woman that killed her family in Texas.
Okay.
I believe she, from everything I read, seriously mentally ill, psychotically depressed. Does she try to hide it? No. Does she go on the lam? No. She kills her children one by one. Hey, I'm a mother. I can understand being angry, but come on. And then calls her husband and then calls the police and tells him what she did.
Mm-hmm.
She had a history of mental illness. She was on a major antipsychotic medication, Haldol. And now people are calling for her to be hung and executed because of what she did. I tell you, not everybody associated with that horrible crime is in jail. The husband and the doctor should be in the jail.
Well, it is a very fine line. I mean, really, in a way, what Bundy did and what she did, both could be classified one way or the other as so deviant from normal as to be dubbed mental illness.
Except that Ted Bundy knew that what he was doing
was wrong,
uh-huh. And I do not believe this woman did. Now, I wasn't there at the time she did it, but I think there's no comparing Ted Bundy planning, stalking, luring, torturing, and then raping and killing women.
You're a strong believer in the death penalty.
You know what, Art? Not as strong as I used to be.
Really?
Too many people have gotten off of death row because DNA cleared them, so how can I be... I'm not the hang-em-high person I used to be.
Yeah, that is a recent trend and very worrisome and concerning. It should be for everybody. So many DNA reports suddenly springing people who were on death row out of death row. Any proponent of the death penalty has got to at least be considering that.
Absolutely. I have, you know, and getting back to the mentally ill, before we get into the death penalty thing, because I can see this is going to really get into a long conversation. I mean, I think a society should be judged on how they treat their mentally ill, and I don't think we do a very good job in this country.
Nor do I. Listen, we're right at the top of the hour, and we'll pick up on this when we get back. Stay right there. Candace DeLong, her book is Special Agent, My Life on the Front Lines as a Woman in the FBI. Check it out on Amazon.com through my website right now. I'm Art Bell.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from August 28th, 2001. Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from August 28, 2001.
20 years in the FBI, and then she wrote a book. And it's out now. Special Agent, My Life on the Front Lines as a Woman in the FBI. I bet a lot of people, when she wrote that book, well, she was in the process, wondered what she was going to write. Bet a lot of people wondered what she was going to write. Candace DeLong will be right back. Here, once again, is Candace DeLong. And if you fit into a category roughly described as not a danger to yourself or a danger to others, and yet you are not well enough mentally to hold down a job or be socially functional, then you fall through the cracks in America, and I think that's kind of what we were talking about at the top of the hour. Is that about the right category, Candace?
Well, in a way, oftentimes if someone is their mental illness is too severe for them to hold a job, and that would be generally we're talking about someone who's schizophrenic.
Sure.
And just so to have the listening audience know what I mean by that for sure, that does not mean multiple personality or split personality. Schizophrenics are, it's a terrible, it's the most serious mental illness there is. It's characterized by delusions and auditory hallucinations. I mean,
sure.
These people actually believe alien spaceships are controlling their mind and sending radio beams through the fillings in their teeth. And they may actually be hearing voices in their head that are very persecutory in nature. You know, I never had a schizophrenic tell me that the voices in their head tell them, gee, you really look good today, Candace.
Right.
I mean, they're horrible things.
Sure they are.
And they drive them to distraction. With medication and treatment, oftentimes the auditory hallucinations and the delusions can be brought to a minimal so that sometimes they can hold menial jobs. But oftentimes they can't. And if they get into the system at some point, then they can be put on SSI disability income.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason for a seriously ill, mentally ill person in our society to be on the street begging for money. There's no reason for it all.
But they are there.
You and I pay a lot of taxes so that they don't have to do that. So if they are doing it, either they have never gotten into the system or for some reason or another, can have enough money through SSI disability to have an inexpensive apartment, renting a room and enough and food stamps. They do not have to do that.
But they do.
And not just the mentally ill, but the physically disabled too. Yes, they do. But as I mentioned earlier, oftentimes these are the homeless people on the streets that are not asking you for money.
Maybe we can't be so proud of the society we have created until we finally get to that problem. I've said that for years, and I believe that too.
I think we dropped the ball when it comes to taking care of the mentally ill in this country. And it's not something, you know, I'm sure there's a certain number of your listeners going, oh, come on, who cares? That doesn't affect me. Believe me.
No.
We need to take care of the mentally ill because it very much can affect you. I even have a discussion in my book of one of the more famous cases, one of the original cases on profiling, where profiling really worked out well. The profile itself led to the identification and subsequent apprehension of a gruesome serial killer who was committing serious, horrible murders because of his delusions. He was killing people and drinking their blood. It was a Sacramento vampire murder case in 1978.
Right.
He was killing people, disemboweling them, and drinking their blood because he really believed, and had for 10 years, that alien spaceships were drying up his blood, turning his blood into mud, and he had to replace it. For years, he killed small animals and drank their blood, and then he moved on to people.
Actually, that's classic vampire behavior.
Vampirism is a clinical term. Did you know that?
That's right. Well, listen, I talked to a bishop in Great Britain who's been dealing with vampires all his adult life and killed one. It was quite a story.
Yikes.
Yikes is right. And that brings me to this question. You know, my program frequently focuses on X-Files kinds of things. Did you, during your period in the FBI, ever hear of any investigation that was going on that sounded kind of like an X-Files investigation?
Well, you know, the thing is, I get asked this all the time. Actually, we used to work the X-Files, but we've got the alien population now well under control. Most of them work for the IRS. If that sounded rehearsed, it was.
Yeah, I understand.
No, I never did.
You never did is the answer.
No. And I think, you know, if there is anything like that, I have a feeling that would fall under the purview of the United States Air Force.
Okay, I want to ask you about two things that are not going to be easy now, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The first is, what were your emotions and thoughts when you saw the compound at Waco go up in flames?
Well, I thought it was a very, it was a 51-day fugitive standoff.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered why, when we had snipers on numerous occasions, FBI snipers had David Koresh's head in the crosshairs of their scopes,
mm-hmm.
why they didn't take him out.
I think we
wrong
all.
Or right, I believe that oftentimes when, you know, you cut off the head, the rest of the snake will die.
Mm-hmm.
It was horrible that those children died. The FBI, I believe, was not responsible for that. We did not set fires. We you know, it had a horrible ending. However, I know there's been videos made. There's a lot of the conspiracy theorists. You know, FBI started the fire, and for it, you know, that didn't happen. You know, and there's been a tremendous amount of taxpayers' money spent on proving that it didn't happen.
But couldn't David Koresh have been taken, if not out, into custody, without having it turn into this godforsaken standoff that it did?
Well, you know, people forget this. This did not start out as an FBI case. That was an ATF case.
Well, indeed, but I do recall, as I think most of the public does, almost a daily briefing by the head FBI fellow at Waco once it got there.
Right. What a lot of people don't realize that initially the ATF was serving a legal search warrant, and seven agents were shot, four died.
Right.
And then the FBI was called in. And so and then of course we were there. The whole thing went up in flames, and we had put tear gas into the compound.
Were you there?
No, goodness no.
No.
You know, the FBI was there. We put tear gas into the compound. Usually that has the effect of people come out. You know, it had gone on for 51 days. Disastrous consequences, for sure.
Yeah, I remember the FBI agent in charge saying, "We'll wait until hell freezes over if we have to."
Well, really? That didn't happen. It is my understanding, based on congressional hearings and congressional testimony at least three times, that we had reason to believe that Koresh was... I know that Koresh was about to do something very serious, and that the greatest negotiators that we had believed that he was about to do something serious, kill his own people, whatever. And so at that point, we moved in, put in the tear gas to get the people out, and you saw what happened.
Sure.
I mean, he set the place on fire. Most of the people that were killed in the compound, there were people piled up, his own people piled up in front of the exit doors, with bullets in the back of their head.
You probably got to watch it on CNN, like most everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
What was the mood in the FBI, when all that came down?
Mixed. Of course, you can imagine that because it is our own agency, and we are pro-law enforcement, and also a conservative agency, that there were a lot of feelings and thoughts that, you know, gee, it's really bad it went down this way, but we're glad it's over. On the other hand, it was, you know, that there were so many children died. I never saw what happened as murder. I came home one day shortly after that happened. I lived in a residential neighborhood in Chicago, a suburb, and one of my neighbors, I got out of my car, I said, "Hi, how you doing?" She turned her back to me. I thought she didn't hear me, and I said, "Hey, how you doing?"
Yeah.
And she turned to me, and she said, "How could you kill babies?"
So it was demoralizing.
It was demoralizing, and I lived through a few of these in my 20 years in the FBI. Ruby Ridge, Waco.
Ruby Ridge was going to be the next one I was going to ask you about.
Yeah, when actually most people don't realize this, but Ruby Ridge was before Waco happened.
Mm-hmm. Some pretty rough stuff at Ruby Ridge.
Once again, the FBI called in after.
I know, but you correct me if I'm wrong here. Didn't this begin over a gun barrel that was maybe a quarter or half an inch or something, too much sawed off, but a tiny amount, relatively?
I don't know the exact details. All I know is that it was another federal agency had him on some kind of weapons charge, and sent up the U.S. Marshals to get him, and things went from bad to worse. I can tell you that when I was in Montana on the Kaczynski situation, we had many, many long hours, many discussions about how to arrest Kaczynski. And we felt that as very strongly, as a result of what happened at Ruby Ridge in Waco, that the best way to get Kaczynski and to not and to avoid another Ruby Ridge or Waco, lure him out and mug him. Mug him when he comes to town, you know, scoop him up, lure him out, grab him. There's no reason for a Cecil B. DeMille production here. The guy's going to come out of his cabin. If he doesn't come out, we'll lure him out. We grab him, put him in cuffs.
Yeah, I take it from the,
while we search his cabin.
From the top in the FBI, I'm sure after these two incidences, that message went out, didn't it?
Well, I would imagine. And that's certainly how we felt, and I was with members of the San Francisco Unabomb Task Force, and that was how we felt. And there also was pressure from headquarters to maybe have the hostage rescue team arrest the Unabomber. Well, I can tell you this. You know, one of FBI agents live for one thing, and it's to arrest someone and put the cuffs on them after a long-term investigation. You don't want to do all the work and then hand it over to somebody else.
Right.
The best part of an investigation is arresting someone. Well, the conviction's the next best thing. But, I mean, come on, you live for that. There was no way we wanted to turn that over to people that hadn't even been involved in the case. And I think, you know, in looking back, we obviously made the right decision. No shots were fired.
Right.
No one was hurt. You know, everything went well. And there you go. Suspect in custody.
All right. We hear about all the ones that turn out well.
Mm-hmm.
We don't hear about the ones that got away. And there have got to be the ones that get away. What was the biggest case, without mentioning names, if it's important not to, that you ever worked on, that you just knew damn well you had the perpetrator or the killer or whatever, and you couldn't get him or her?
Chapter 5 in my book, Over the Counter, The Tylenol Murderer.
Oh, the Tylenol Murderer.
Yes,
you
remember that pesky guy?
Oh, of course. You were on that case?
Yes. I was a rookie. It was 1982. And for your younger listeners, in 1982... Thursday, Friday in Chicago, seven or eight people dropped dead shortly after ingesting Tylenol, unconnected people all over the city, and a link was eventually made. A couple paramedics in different municipalities made the link because they were friends and they talked to each other. And, gee, I took this girl to the hospital after she had taken Tylenol. She's, gee, that's funny. I took this guy to the hospital after, you know, because when you die of a cyanide poisoning, it looks like you're having a heart attack.
Right.
Except 12-year-old girls don't have heart attacks.
Right.
And so they made the connection, and pretty soon it was verified that it was Tylenol, tainted Tylenol, and the race was on. And 1 week after all these people died, extortion note was received by the makers of Tylenol saying, for $1 million, I'll stop the killing. Deposit $1 million in this account, and he gave an account number.
Did they want to pay?
Pardon me?
Did they want to pay?
Oh, they were very cooperative. One of the very first things they did was take all of Tylenol off the shelf. They didn't even have to be asked to. Took all nationwide.
No, but my question was, did they want to pay?
You know, I've never been asked that, and I don't know the answer. I wasn't involved at that level.
Okay.
But the interesting thing about it was, in negotiations with the extortionist, he said, deposit the money in this account at this bank, blah, 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 XXX bank.
Right.
And so we immediately find out who has that account, and it's this businessman who ran an employment agency in Chicago, and it becomes obvious very quickly he is not the guy that sent this extortion note.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the first question you ask anybody like that? Well, who in the world would want to frame you for murder? I mean, one of the highest highest profile crime in America today. I mean, and it says, well, you know, I didn't know I had any. You know, well, I did. You know, there was this woman. I was unable to pay her last paycheck. I went bankrupt. I couldn't pay all my employees. Her husband was very upset about that, and he tried to rally.
To catch the bad guy is to take somebody who committed maybe some kind of horrible crime and plea bargain with him instead of life in prison or the death penalty. You know, you're talking 25 or 20 years or 15 years or even 10 years. Listen, hold on. We'll get to this when we get back. I'm Art Bell. And oh yes, this is Coast to Coast AM.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from August 28, 2001.
Up through tarmac to the sun again, or to fly to the sun without burning a wing, to lie in a meadow and hear the grass sing. To have all these things in our memories haunt, and they use them to help.
Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from August 28, 2001.
Candace DeLong, 20 years in the FBI, is my guest. Her book is Special Agent, My Life on the Front Lines as a Woman in the FBI. You go to my website and you go to program tonight's guest info. It'll take you right over to Amazon.com where you can buy that book at a gigantic discount. And Candace, though, a couple of times saying you're going to have to read the book, has been very candid with us on very, very difficult subjects, and I'm going to take her back to one of them in a moment. I'm Art Bell as we move through the night. Stay right where you are. All right, I'm going to entertain some phone calls this half hour. Just a couple of things that I want to get out of the way. Candace DeLong, once again, welcome back, and thanks for being a trooper and staying with us the whole time here.
Oh, thank you.
Candace, plea bargaining. Mm. Sometimes, to the American public, it is sickening. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine...
Guess what? It's sickening to us, too.
Is it?
Oh, yeah.
In other words, you can have somebody who actually committed a murder, but you need to get somebody even bigger, and you can actually bargain away, almost, it's like bargaining away a life in a way, isn't it?
It seems that way. I have a case that I talk about in my book of a serial killer. I think I mentioned him earlier in Illinois, a serial killer of women and children.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was caught, he immediately cut a deal. You know, I'll tell you where the body is, and, you know, I want life, no parole, you know, rather than death. And the prosecutors took it, and I was livid.
Was it the only way the case was going to get made?
I didn't think so. But I was told, hey, DeLong, a bird in the hand, two in the bush, you never know how a jury's going to go.
Yep.
But you know what? When you've got a dead kid, pretty much who's ever sitting at the defendant's table is going to go away.
Boy, it must make for some long nights. How did you not take a lot of that home with you, or did you?
I did. And at the time, I was raising a little boy who's a young man now, and it was tough. Very, very, very tough. But, you know, you swallow it and you power through it and you go on. If you let it get to you, you can't do your job.
you kind of walked away from the Ruby Ridge question a little bit. Ruby Ridge, again, the same kind of question for you as Waco, and that is, how did that affect you when it came down? How did that affect the agency?
Well, it was disheartening, to say the least. We were generally, well, I'll speak for myself. I can't speak for the agency. I was very, very upset that the Department of Justice paid Randy Weaver, I think, $2 or $3, $4 million. And then later, congressional hearings, we don't even know who shot his son. I would have liked to have seen that adjudicated.
Mm.
I have this to say about Ruby Ridge and Waco. In both situations, the media was very present, very involved, and whenever that happens, we can't do our job effectively. I think personally, and there are those that would be very angry with me saying this, in my profession, I think that the negotiations went on way too long. Yes, better to negotiate and save lives than not negotiate and lose lives, but gosh, look what happened anyway. You know, there's no right or wrong answers. I mean, humans, you know, don't ever count on them too much. They'll always let you down.
How much would you say the agency is moved by the media?
I think when the media gets involved in any case, they can become media. The case can become media driven. That's not always bad. Case in point, the case in the news right now, the Chandra Levy case. I think, but for the media, Chandra Levy would just be another missing person, and this investigation that we've got going wouldn't have happened. And I believe, despite everyone in the world saying you're wrong. I believe this case is going to be solved. I don't know that it's going to be solved tomorrow.
Yeah, I was
but I
ask
think
that.
We are going to know what happened.
Whether you think it'll actually come to a conclusion.
I'm sorry, when or?
No, not when.
Or
you couldn't
do
know
I?
That. But you already answered the question. Now, whether it will ever come to a conclusion.
I believe it will.
Yeah. Okay.
I believe it will.
Let's take a couple of calls. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Candace DeLong and Art Bell. Good morning.
Is that me?
That's you.
Yeah, I have an observation and a question. I'm sure, when the ATF hit Waco, that they had their video cameras running to show essentially how they were going to, and this is a quote on you, how they were going to legally exercise a search warrant. Of course, people came out of Waco, says that Koresh met him at the door and was met with a hail of bullets. Now, they bulldozed the thing afterward. They had a video clip, and it was this was discussed on Art Bell's Kaden show way back when. But anyway, in that video clip, it showed this modified tank chassis delivering your CS hitting the upwind corner of that building. And there was a light in the upper window. That light went down, and a few seconds later, flames came up. Now, ma'am, I don't know how much research you've done on this, but, a conspiracy law not only applies, in my opinion, to we as individuals, but also to people who are involved in this sort of thing. And the National Rifle Association offered on its own expense to X-ray all the weapons, remains that were there to determine whether or not there was anything illegal. And the federal government wouldn't have it. Now, I think that until this is resolved, I think that we really fear a Gestapo-like federal agency. I mean, the kind of thing that happened down there, we never even heard of coming out of Nazi Germany.
All right. Well, now, that man is representative of a lot of thought in the country about that incident.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's justified or not, that's the way it turned out. And there's a lot of people who believe as that man believes.
Mm-hmm.
And that had to have hurt. It hurt everybody. There was an innocent time in America. I grew up in it in the 50s, and God, when the FBI would come out and announce the capture of some fugitive that they'd been after for a long time, man, you could take that to the bank.
Mm-hmm.
The American people would believe the FBI, boom, 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 just like that. Even though J. Edgar Hoover was there, we believed every single word with good reason. And that's just not true anymore, is it?
Well, without question, there's a percentage of Americans that don't believe a single thing good about the FBI. I'll give you that.
So that incident, no matter which side of the aisle you're on, your side or that man's side, it changed something in America, didn't it?
I think it did, and I think it certainly changed the way certain people look at the FBI. But what I also believe is that, you know, in my, you know, 30-plus years as an adult, 10 years in mental health and 20 years with the federal government in a law enforcement agency, you know, there are certain people who hold attitudes that the facts don't matter. You know, and there are certainly people in law enforcement who the facts don't matter.
Yeah, yeah,
and you're never going to have a meeting of the minds. You're never going to have a meeting of the minds.
Okay. Let's keep going. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Candace Long. Hello. Hello there. Nope. First-time caller line, you're on the air. Hello. Okay, turn your radio off, please.
Okay.
Okay, you're on the air, sir.
Hi, Art. It's a pleasure to speak to you. I'm a truck driver, and I live in Huntington Beach. My name is Sam.
Yes, Sam.
I have a question. Is there a department such as the X-Files?
Well, we already asked that one. Actually, though you said you never saw it, you sort of did say there was an X-Files, or were you just joking?
I was joking. I think, you know, if you're talking about investigation of UFOs...
No, not necessarily. But there are an awful lot of things. Well, for example, a lot of law enforcement agencies are known to use psychics.
Not us.
Remote
viewers.
Want
to know what I think about psychics?
Yep.
I'll be happy to tell you.
Sure, go ahead.
To quote Mark Kloss, father of kidnap, rape, murder victim Polly Kloss,
yes,
psychics are the second wave of predators. This is what I have to say to psychics, because I worked cases, the vast majority of cases that I worked as a profiler had to do with missing people and murdered people, women and children, and psychics come out of, and they all say the same thing, I see water, I see a fence, and this is what I have to say to them, hand them a shovel and say, really, you know where the victim is? Here, show me where you are going to dig. I have never known, ever, in my 20 years as an agent, of a psychic to be accurate. Never.
Okay.
If they were that good, and if there were so many of them that are that good, how come we have so many missing people and unsolved murders? And that is a statement as well as a question.
Actually, let me turn it on you. How many missing people do we have and unsolved murders?
Goodness, I annually?
Annually, I guess.
I would think annually, missing persons and unsolved murders, thousands.
Thousands.
Mm-hmm.
Thousands of people who are gone without explanation, without conclusive investigation,
mm-hmm,
just gone.
A lot of people go missing and they're never even reported missing. You know, I mean, there's 280 million people in this country.
Well, then an obvious...
Now, when a child goes missing, that's noticed.
Yeah, but then an obvious follow-up question is, then really, how many unsolved crimes do we have versus solved by percentage?
I think, and I'm, don't hold me to this, but I think in terms of homicides, like when you've got a documented homicide, someone has been murdered.
Yes.
And in terms of unsolved, the vast majority of them are solved. I think well over 80% are solved.
But if you factor in the missing and the unaccounted for.
Oh, well, then I would imagine the number is astronomical. A lot of people go missing having nothing to do with having met a violent end by another person. People with Alzheimer's walk out of their homes and walk into the forest. Mentally ill people walk into that people just go missing for a variety of reasons that have nothing to do with being murdered or you know, some people meet with a terribly violent, untimely demise that had nothing to do with another person.
So that could be the case with Chandra Levy.
It could be, but I don't think it is.
I understand that. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Candace DeLong and Art Bell. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay, sir. Where are you?
Turn off my radio.
Okay, thank you. Please do that, everybody. Have it handy so you can turn it off. Where are you and what's your first name?
Victor, and I'm in Kennewick, Washington.
Okay, fire away, Victor.
I just wanted to say I'm really intrigued by the topic tonight. I'm also a Law and Order fan.
Great show. Dynamite show. Yes, sir. Anyway, do you have a question?
Well, more of a
statement?
Kind of a statement, a question statement, I guess.
Okay, go.
For your guest.
Go ahead. We don't have a lot of time, sir. Go ahead.
About mentally ill people.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to be mentally ill. I have I'm manic depressive.
Mm-hmm.
And not all mentally ill people lack a conscience.
Absolutely, I agree with
course.
You.
I am one. I have a problem with theft.
Mm-hmm.
A theft problem, but I do have a conscience about it.
Okay.
And I just wanted to say that.
No, I'm. You bring up a good point, and I certainly didn't mean to convey to anyone that I believe the mentally ill are without conscience. In fact, basically, the only type of mental illness of category of people that don't seem to have a conscience is a category that we would call the sociopath, the psychopath, or the antisocial personality. Certainly not people with your diagnosis.
But the fact that he has a conscience, that he feels badly about what he has done, implies clearly that he understands he is doing wrong when he does it.
Yes, otherwise he wouldn't feel the guilt.
So then if he were to be caught for stealing, it's prosecutable, right?
Well, yes.
First-time caller line, you're on the air with Candace DeLong and Art Bell. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, sir.
Hi. Am I live?
I don't know. You seem alive.
Okay, that's a very good sense of humor.
Where are you, sir?
I'm calling you from the Midwest.
Okay.
I would just like to know, first of all, good morning, everyone. Secondly, I'll be short and brief. When the United States Justice Department, they definitely have a lot on their hands from immigration to law enforcement. But I was wondering if your guest is being less than forthcoming or simply does not know or want to acknowledge human intelligence, electronic intelligence, rumor intelligence, the operation of American armed forces on American soil, working against Americans themselves. This is not something I'm making up.
Give us instead
an instance,
instead,
for instance.
Give us a for instance. Good.
A for instance would be when the FBI goes in. Let's make it the DEA. When they make a seizure, this is intelligence that's gathered by recon units and the United States Marine Corps. Generally, usually 80-90% of the time, they go in, leave. They give the DEA the information that they need. The DEA lands. They confiscate. And then they make the headlines. But they didn't really do the intelligence work, as I was talking about, rumor intelligence, human intelligence, electronic intelligence, signals intelligence. In Waco, for instance, the intelligence that was given to the United States Justice Department ahead of time was that Mr. Koresh could have been picking up jogging.
In town. But as she pointed out, they were serving a search warrant when all this began. But, you know, you've got a good point. Hindsight is always 20/20. But, again, Candace, we don't have a lot of time here, but there is a man who believes that U.S. military forces are being used in conjunction with domestic federal agencies like the FBI, for example. Mm-hmm. You want to comment on that?
Well, I believe that it was at least two presidential administrations ago where I think it had to do with the drug war. I could be wrong on this, and President Bush, where we got involved and started using U.S. military to help us on the war on drugs. Regarding their involvement on anything not drug-related, I couldn't comment on that. I did work drugs for 3 years. I worked with the DEA. I never worked with the military. I'm reading a book right now called Killing Pablo about the hunt.
Escobar, yeah.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating.
What is your position on the drug war, Candace? If you were the drug czar, You've looked at all this long enough to come to some sort of conclusion. A lot of very conservative people are beginning to say, that's it, enough. We've got to change our drug laws in America. Are you one of those?
No. And I do have a very strong statement about that in my book. However, my feelings about, I mean, I used to be of the feeling, come on, let's start locking up the users again. Well, there aren't enough prisons. We'd have to build so many more. And, I mean, we have to stop the demand for drugs, and I think probably the only way to do that is in increased education and starting it in kindergarten.
About 60% of the incarcerated now, I understand, which top a million easily, going toward 2 million, I think.
Right, right.
That's all drug-related, right?
Yes, and something like over 50% of the prisoners brought into Cook County Jail in Chicago were tested, and I think it was something like 64% of them committed the crime when they were either high on drugs or alcohol. Don't ask me if I think we should legalize. Well, I do not think we should legalize drugs. I do not.
No change in our drug laws at all. Tougher, if anything. Huh?
Well, I don't know about that. You know, I have a problem sending a ghetto mom who's trying to feed two kids to prison for 10 years because she was running drugs so she could buy groceries for her kids. We need to do something with her, but we definitely need to get her. We need to get her bosses in jail. Very tough to do. I'll tell you straight up. I don't have an answer to the drug problem, but I do not want to see drugs legalized in this country. I think it's a huge mistake.
If it were up to you, would you mobilize the military domestically to attack the problem harder?
I've never been asked that. But
now you have.
Okay, let's imagine I have a crown on my head. I'm liking it. Yeah, I think I would.
You would.
And I'll tell you why, Art. I think drugs and guns are the worst thing to ever happen in this country.
Guns,
I was
too,
raised like you in the 50s. Drugs didn't exist. Look at us now.
Oh, yeah, that's right. In the 50s, Roy, they didn't. They began to exist in large quantities.
In the late 60s, early 70s.
That's right.
Yeah, and look at us now. You know, I mean, you know, our children face things. I mean,
Candace, the show is coming to an end because I've got a horrible back and I'm doing 4 hours. I want to have you back and I want to do this again because we have just begun into an area that needs a lot more explanation. So can we do this again?
Absolutely.
Good luck with your book. You're going to do very well.
Thank you. I'm very pleased so far.
Good night, Candace.
Okay.
Take care. Good night, all.